Morning, counsel.
Good morning, distinguished Chief Justice Steele, distinguished members of the court. Thomas D. Donovan, on behalf of the appellant, Quantico Ross. Seated at counsel table is my partner, Melissa A. Hopkins, member of the bar.
Good morning.
We are here for Quantico Ross's direct appeal. He entered a guilty plea in Superior Court here in Kent County and was sentenced under 11 Delaware Code 1448E1C. We are arguing that Mr. Ross should be sentenced under 1448E1A. The question before the court is what is conviction in terms of these penalty enhancing this penalty enhancing statute. We had argued at the court in the court below that Mr. Ross had one prior conviction for purposes of sentencing and having an enhanced penalty of a one-year minimum mandatory sentence imposed. The state argued that it was a five-year minimum mandatory that would be imposed. We use the term overlapping convictions as a term of art, I think, as the attorneys in the court below. Situations undisputed, Mr. Ross was convicted of a crime, predicate felony, was subsequently arrested and convicted prior to his sentencing for the first felony, and so we use the term overlapping convictions.
If you use the definition of an adjudication of guilt, there are three successive convictions, one March 8th, 94, another July 26th, 94, and then the third May 18, 2009.
Right? Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. And the state concedes that Mr. Ross was not subject to 4214 provisions under the habitual offender statute for those reasons, that there was one conviction prior to sentencing back in the 90s. So in terms of successive convictions, yes, our argument is that there was two total convictions. However, the habitual offender statute doesn't apply, but we look to this court's interpretation of that statute as the basis of our argument here today. I don't think there's an argument from the state that we're dealing with one or two prior convictions for purposes of 1448 only, and it doesn't apply to 4214, and they did not seek any sentencing under the habitual offender statute. The issue that we see here is that there was a case back in the 70s, 1974, it was Lease, L-I-S, I don't know if that's proper pronunciation, but in that case, the court had dealt with a mandatory sentence that was to be imposed upon the defendant. He had been convicted, he pled guilty, and the next day he was arrested and tried and convicted for a subsequent felony, possession with intent to deliver marijuana, I believe. However, he had not been sentenced. He had been sentenced in that case. He had received a suspended sentence, was placed on probation, and sometime later he was arrested, convicted, and he argued to the court that, well, since he received a suspended sentence, he should not be subjected to the minimum mandatory sentence that the court imposed. Now, we agree with the result in Lease, but the court notes at the end, it's a very short opinion, that their definition of conviction, the court's definition of conviction was one that adjudication of guilt was sufficient for finding this triggering minimum mandatory penalty to apply. And that reasoning was followed again years later and prior.
Can you articulate for me exactly what the trial court got wrong and what we're supposed to do to correct it?
Well, the court did not interpret the what a predicate conviction entailed. If we look directly at the statute, it's ironic that there are three subsections here in 1448. We've got a one-year minimum mandatory, a three-year minimum mandatory, and a five-year minimum mandatory. The sections that we think are applicable, we say the 1 year, the state says the 5 year, don't mention anything about what a conviction really is. But the section that doesn't apply is the three-year minimum mandatory, which talks about a conviction of an offense within a 10-year time period. And it contemplates specifically in the statute that the 10 years begins in terms of tabulation either when a conviction occurs or when a finality of sentence terminates. So the statute itself contemplates a...
What do you mean the finality of the sentence terminates?
A termination of the periods of incarceration or other penalties imposed. So the statute itself contemplates a sentence being imposed on an individual for purposes of enhancing the penalty in a subsequent conviction and sentencing.
All right, that's what the statute says. What did the trial judge get wrong?
Well, the trial judge did not interpret this statute to hold that a sentencing was required and a period of rehabilitation or some time period must elapse in order to consider a prior conviction, a separate conviction, for purposes of enhancing the penalty.
Now, what is it that would mandate that period of rehabilitation?
Well, we believe that this court's rulings in Buckingham and Hall would be consistent with that, with the holding that whenever a penalty-enhancing statute is imposed, some period of rehabilitation, at least some period of rehabilitation, must occur before the court can deem a conviction a conviction. Meaning the conviction isn't born out of a finding of guilt. A conviction is born out of a finality of judgment, meaning a sentence is imposed, an individual is his sentence is finalized, and he's given some chance to rehabilitate himself.
So there were three adjudications, consecutive adjudications of guilt. That's not disputed, correct?
I believe we were
correct.
The third adjudication
was an adjudication.
Well, the third finding of guilt and sentencing is what we're before.
I understand that, but okay. There were three adjudications of guilt.
I believe there were two that we were. That we were addressing back in the 90s, two adjudications.
Two. And there were two sentences that followed that adjudication.
I believe, yes.
So your argument is that we're missing only one element, and that is the elapse of some undefined period for rehabilitation.
Yes.
And you concede there's nothing in the statute that requires that. Is that correct?
Right. The statute doesn't, and just like in the habitual offender statute, it doesn't specifically state that a period of time.
So if we were to hold that is a requirement, what would be the source of that legal rule that you're arguing for?
Well, I would say that, number one, the statute itself does contemplate a sentence.
Well, it doesn't require it. So if it contemplates it, what's the basis for making that statement?
Well, I think consistency and fairness, I guess, at the foundation of it. In Hall, the court said...
Where is the text from which you can argue that the statute contemplates?
I was referring to 11 Delco 1448, subsection E1B, where in that penalty-enhancing portion of the statute... requires a three-year minimum mandatory sentence to be imposed if a person is convicted of a violent if a person has been convicted of a violent felony within 10 years, that 10-year time period being either the date of conviction or of being adjudged guilty or the date any sentence has terminated, whichever is later. So
you cited State versus Anderson, Judge James's decision, and he describes in that case the prefatory or the whereas clauses in the Mandatory Sentencing Act, and one of them is this: whereas mandatory prison terms applied to adults require that an offender has an opportunity to mend his ways after an initial confrontation with the courts before he is sentenced as a second offender. Is that a legislative adoption of Hall and to all mandatory sentencing schemes?
It appears as though that is it appears that way, and I would certainly argue that. I don't know exactly what the impetus was for that mandate. Although we agree with the holding in Anderson, and we think that that case should be followed. I think it was a well-reasoned opinion. In fact, the state was arguing back then in 1994, what we're arguing here today is that the court should look at its penalty-enhancing statute for the juvenile offender in family court and follow the reasoning and logic that was followed in Hall and Buckingham. That language would certainly be applicable in this and any mandatory sentencing statute, we believe.
So we can use whereas clauses in statutory enactments to discern a legislative intent for other sentencing provisions?
Well, legislation which defines conviction or gives the court direction on how to interpret what a conviction is, I believe that would certainly be acceptable to follow this reasoning, since it was followed in Hall and Buckingham. Quite frankly, I don't know if that whereas clause is still in existence. I don't have that in front of me. I just have the opinion from the family court.
No, it's in the statute, isn't it? Or in the legislative enactment?
And I don't have that in front of me, Your Honor. But certainly that court was convinced that there is some contemplation of a finality of judgment, and it doesn't, and the conviction or the adjudication of guilt is not final. It's the sentence that is imposed.
Is there a line of federal cases that discuss the imposition of the three strikes and out application of a life sentence after three prior felonies under some habitual offender statute that discuss the imposition of a life sentence as with implications of the due process clause, suggesting similar to your argument that before a life sentence can be imposed under any state's habitual offender statute in order to satisfy the federal due process clause, that there has to be a period of time for a defendant to rehabilitate before that person can be sentenced to life?
I don't know the answer to that question. I was relying on the Delaware state cases.
I realize this isn't the imposition of a life sentence, but it strikes me that there are several federal cases that discuss the due process implications of a three strikes and out habitual offender statute when the ultimate penalty is life imprisonment. I don't know whether that theory that due process is implicated in a life sentence under an habitual offender statute has any application here, but it sounds like your argument is a variation on that theme.
That is correct. And when Buckingham, that may have been applicable only if Hall had been around, but Buckingham came in and applied those same principles to the discretionary life statute, the subsection A of 4214. And our argument is that it's discretionary, meaning the court can impose a sentence of zero to life. And so we don't think the habitual offender statute, because the possibility of life exists, would make it that much different from any other penalty-enhancing statute. This court has looked at habitual offender sentences and the statute itself, and we refer to that statute because that's really the only line of case law that has developed in this court.
Well, I didn't articulate my question, my comment very well, but my point is there or are there any due process implications that raise federal constitutional issues for your argument today?
Well, as I stated, yes, there is a fundamental due process right that is touched upon here whenever there's a penalty-enhancing statute, and I think the statute should be read strictly in favor of a defendant who is subject to an enhanced penalty because of status, which would be a prior conviction. So, yes, I mean, there are implications of due process here and in any penalty-enhancing case.
Did you want to save the balance of your argument?
No other further questions. That's
okay.
Well, thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice. Justices, good morning. I'd like to start, if I could, with addressing the Chief Justice's question, the last posed questions regarding a due process, federal due process claim. I suggest that first, if we look to the federal habitual offender statutes, and I'm talking about the life statutes, and then I'm going to talk in a moment about a separate statute, the Armed Career Criminal Statute, which is much more akin to what we're dealing with here, a person prohibited statute regarding firearms. The only due process issue would be if the person could not be aware of the status prior to convicting the crime that's going to be enhanced. In other words, if in fact he committed the crime, it was his charges were pending, he hadn't pled yet, he hadn't been sentenced yet, and then he commits the crime to be enhanced, this present crime, there may be a due process issue there. And in fact, I'd suggest that that's pretty much where Hall and Buckingham come from, that the person must know that he or she has obtained that final status before they commit this crime. When we apply it here, there can be no doubt that Quantico Ross knew, in fact, that he was not just a felon, but for the purposes of this statute, to a certain extent, when he decided to hold that 45 Glock, that in fact he was, for lack of a better term, an aggravated felon when we look at this, that he had two prior separate felony convictions. The language that's at issue here is been convicted on two or more separate occasions of a violent felony. No question this was a violent felony. No question that they happened on two different dates. And in fact, if anyone should be the poster child for why we should not use the overlapping felony theory, it's Quantico Ross. He commits a drug felony, possession with intent, in December. He pleads in March. 6 weeks later, while he's out on bail pending sentencing, he commits the same felony again. He then gets locked up and is eventually sentenced for the first. He has a separate plea entered later on the second. He has a separate sentence on the second. So by the time...
Would your argument be the same? The second offense is April 25, 94. May 13, he's sentenced on the first offense, and then he enters a guilty plea on the second offense on July 26. Theoretically, he could have entered that guilty plea on May 13, 94, the same date he was sentenced on the first offense. Would your argument be the same then, or what would the rule be then?
I believe it would be the same because he would have been convicted on two or more separate occasions. The one conviction...
Isn't that exactly Hall?
I don't believe it is, because what we have here is he was convicted. The first conviction occurred on March 8th of 1994. He was sentenced in May. The second conviction would then occur in May at the same time as the sentence. So I would suggest when you look at the language of the statute itself, been convicted on two or more separate occasions, First conviction occurs May 8th when he enters the plea to the first one. He then has knowledge. Look, I am a convicted felon. 222 says conviction occurs at the time of plea or entry of verdict of guilt. He knows then that he is a convicted felon. In fact, if he picked up a firearm then, prior to even being sentenced, he would be subjected to the person prohibited statute because he's already a convicted felon. He has knowledge. That I would suggest, Mr. Chief Justice, is the only real federal due process issue, and that is whether or not he has sufficient warning that he may be subjected to enhanced sentencing. And when they enter a plea of guilt, the statutory language that is applicable here makes it clear that they have that knowledge. They know then, I am a convicted felon and I may not go near firearms.
Is the statutory language defining a conviction consistent with our case law? And by that I mean, it strikes me that we have several cases that say a conviction is not final until sentencing. Is that finality a different kind of finality than what we're talking about here?
I suggest respectfully it is, because most of those have to do, there's the habitual offender, the 4214 cases, which I suggest are a bit of a different animal in a way. Then we talk about finality for other purposes, and most of the time it's some type of procedural purpose as opposed to a warning about someone's future behavior. And when we look at what the purpose of this statute is, from 1969, Delaware courts have said, this statute is to ensure that people who we have deemed to be non-trustworthy should go nowhere near firearms. This is very specific. It deals with violent felonies. It deals with firearms. That's the only time it is going to be applicable, and it's when there are multiple felonies. I'd also suggest that if, in fact, the legislature meant something different, they certainly know how to say it. We've mentioned, for instance, in the Superior Court Rule 32B, that's not a legislative act, but at very least, the legislature could have adopted the language from that, judgment of conviction, which has been interpreted to mean it also must include sentencing. There's also another legislative act which occurred, which adopted the habitual offender no overlapping felony or no overlapping offenses. Our DUI law does specifically that. There is a specific statute, and in fact, that came into effect before these provisions. That came into effect in 1998. 2003, the legislature is writing this statute. If, in fact, they wanted to adopt that language, and that's certainly one theory of legislative interpretation, if they know how to say it, they will say it, that, in fact, specifically at 4177, large B, E4, it defines that they have to be separate and distinct and that there is no overlap. So if the legislature meant it, they certainly know how to say it. They had said it in a sentencing enhancement statute before this.
Well, did they say it in the language quoted by Judge James in State versus Anderson?
I'd suggest no, Mr. Justice Ridgely, and here's why. I believe that all that does, that language there, simply gets back to, if we look at what it is, the mandatory prison terms applied to adults require that an offender has an opportunity to mend his ways after an initial confrontation with the courts before he is sentenced as a second offender. I suggest it gets directly back to the due process argument I initially made, and that is the state absolutely agrees that if the person has only been arrested for the felony and there has been no conviction prior to the enhanced crime or the crime to be enhanced, that it is not applicable. He hasn't been before a court, been adjudicated guilty, whether sentences occurred yet or not, hasn't been adjudicated guilty and said, I understand, for instance, in this case, I no longer have a right to hold a firearm. They say that at the time of plea, in fact. Quantico Ross would have known that. So I would suggest that this language that the court cites, and I'm setting aside for a second what its persuasive value is as far as legislative history of this statute, because I think that we could go down a long trail that way. But let's assume that it has some persuasive value. It's certainly not inconsistent, because the state's position is that once the person enters the plea, once they are convicted, as Section 222 defines conviction, a verdict of guilt is entered, they have entered a plea, then this whereas clause is met. They have had that opportunity to mend their ways after initial confrontation with the court. They have been told, you are now a convicted felon. It is now a matter of record. And if they go out and commit a new crime, for instance, if they take a firearm when they've been a violent felony, they're going to be subjected to harsher punishment.
Is that language, that whereas language, an adoption of Hall? Or does it replicate what Hall held?
I don't know that it fully does, because it doesn't say that. Because what Hall does is really, Hall is a calculus case about all of the prior convictions. There's no doubt from Hall and Buckingham that even that third felony, the sentencing for it, or at least the conviction for it, must occur before the fourth felony in Hall and the third felony in Buckingham, because we're talking about two different men, parts of 4214, must have occurred before the crime to be enhanced. I think that's the bottom line. I think there is a running string of logic in all of these, and that is that they simply must know before they commit this crime that they are going to get an enhanced penalty for, that they are going to be subject to it, and they do know in various ways.
Well, and you're saying, if I understand your position correctly, number one, that that's the only conceivable basis for a federal constitutional claim, and number two, no such claim has been advanced here, correct?
Certainly not has been here.
So is it also the case that the only issue before us is one of statutory interpretation?
Yes.
And in that regard, I don't know whether you agree or disagree with the proposition that a sentencing is required in addition to an adjudication of guilt to constitute a conviction for purposes of the statute.
The state disagrees wholly.
It doesn't matter, however. I mean, in this case, it appears that there were both adjudications of guilt as well as separate sentences.
No, it does not matter. It only matters if you're going to try to use the Hall-Buckingham calculus, because Hall and Buckingham, basically, this court held that you must have occurrence, sentence, new crime occurrence, sentence, new crime occurrence, sentence. And I suggest that I don't know that that language was required. It was certainly required from the statutory language, and I'm certainly, because I don't need to, I'm certainly not going to criticize it here, but there is some sense to it before you ensure that someone is going to be eligible for what is the second harshest possible sentence under our criminal law, an absolute natural life sentence. That's what people get if they get a life sentence under either 4214A or B. So to ensure that, and it was, honestly, it's judicially created interpretation of the language, because it wasn't required by the language there. But I'd suggest that once that interpretation was there, and once we look at what the statutory language adopted for this crime is, and they are two very different situations, that it is clear that had the legislature wanted to adopt the Hall and Buckingham interpretation for this statute, they would have done specifically that. They know how to do it.
Okay, and it appears, and tell me if I've got this right or wrong, that what's being interpreted, or the issue in terms of the Hall-Buckingham line of cases, doesn't go to conviction. It goes to distinct or separate. Is that right?
Yes. What Hall and Buckingham did was basically adopted a calculus that meant those crimes had to be separate and distinct. In other words, that occurrence, sentence. It wasn't required. It certainly wasn't required by the statutory language, and I don't doubt the wisdom of it. We've dealt with it for decades. But I suggest that an attempt to now take it and translate it into here isn't what the legislature intended.
Okay, so you're making two statutory interpretation arguments, or at least responses to the other side's argument. Number one, that the basis for their argument is out of context. That is, it may apply in a different statutory context, but it doesn't apply here. And secondly, there's no basis in the statute to to engraft that gloss onto the statute, that the statute is clear on its face, and that's the end of the analysis.
That is the state's position, yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree that if the test is whether the offender has an opportunity to mend his ways after an initial confrontation with the courts before he is sentenced as a second offender, that if, hypothetically, that it is the test, that there cannot be the enhancement in this case?
If that is meant that they may not overlap, much like Hall and Buckingham, then that would be true. Then these do overlap. If we were here in a habitual criminal context, he could not be subjected to that.
So the narrow issue before us is whether that's the test or whether the simple conviction calculus 1, 2, 3 is the test. Is that our choice?
As the appellant has posed it, yes. But I would suggest that, yes. To answer your question more simply, yes. Those are the choices. Can the prior convictions overlap or not? Can there be any kind of overlap between the two?
Would I be wrong to suggest that Hall and Buckingham were not rooted in statutory interpretation, but in fact rooted in due process concerns?
Certainly the language of those.
Maybe yes. The distinction is the potential life imprisonment versus the kind of enhancement we're talking about here, but it's not a statutory interpretation analysis for Hall and Buckingham, is it?
No, it's not. It speaks much more to the language or the language used by my opponent when he was here, and that is fundamental fairness and things like that. But I would suggest that when we I think the court went further than the court needed to go in Hall versus Buckingham, but I'm not here to discuss the habitual criminal statute and whether or not it should be interpreted that way. I think the bottom line, though, is that at very least, if we talk about a minimum for due process to ensure that a statute doesn't, the minimum must be that the person has knowledge, that the conviction has actually occurred prior to the incident that will be enhanced. And I can't tell you that that's true in all types of statutes, even some federal statutes.
Well, if the case law suggests to the attorney representing the individual that the conviction isn't final until sentencing, how do we conclude that the defendant's on notice after he found guilty or pleads guilty, but before sentencing, that he's subject to an enhanced penalty because he has been convicted? As his attorney, what do you tell him? That it's obviously not in your best interest to possess a firearm between now and sentencing or ever again, for sure. But if the question is posed to the attorney at the time, now, as I begin to mend my ways, having been convicted of this crime in the sense of being adjudicated guilty, when does my rehabilitation begin? Before I get any instruction from the court about what my sentence is and what I have to do in order to attain the ultimate goal of satisfying society that I've paid for my crime? Or do I begin from the time I've been adjudicated guilty, even before I'm told what the necessary steps are for my rehabilitation?
I suggest the latter. I suggest respectfully that what is required is simply knowledge. Knowledge that, in fact, you are now a convicted felon, and that any type of proceedings thereafter has nothing to do with whether or not you should, in fact, change your behavior, not take control of the firearm when you are a convicted felon. And I suggest that as to the first part of Your Honor's question related to, well, what does the case law say? Actually, the case law, the more applicable case law in this case, would have been Liss and Pryor, not Hall and Buckingham, because Liss and Pryor both said if you convicted a crime that was going to enhance a specific offense, in those cases drugs, and more specifically prior than Liss, because Liss, he had been sentenced, but it was a suspended sentence. Prior then added on to it, he hadn't even been sentenced yet. That's the applicable case law in this case, not Hall and Buckingham. And I suggest that if you look elsewhere, for instance, If you look to the other clues in the statute, if there's no case on point, which there isn't in this case, because this particular sentencing provision has never been interpreted, if you have to look at the other clues, well, you need to look at the specific language of the statute. That doesn't tell you that they can't be overlapping. You can't look at 222 because that tells you that as soon as you've been adjudicated guilty, a conviction has occurred.
And if I understand your argument, any concerns about due process that we might have are satisfied because the applicability of due process fundamental fairness here touches on notice. And anyone who has pled guilty or been found guilty of a crime for which a later punishment can be enhanced is on notice from the moment they plead or are found guilty that they're in a situation where a future crime could trigger the statute.
Yes, that is the state's position. And I suggest to just get back to the answer I was finishing, because I do believe it ties into the question Your Honor just asked.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
No.
I was afraid I'd forget the question if I didn't ask it as soon as it came to mind.
I hope I just answered that question. But to get back to the other clues, the Armed Career Criminal Act works specifically this way. The federal Armed Career Criminal Act. The court had asked about some federal authority, and I'd suggest the authority interpreting 18 U.S.C. 924E1 is much more applicable to our person prohibited statute, that's the Armed Career Criminal Act, than this is. And that looks at criminal episodes. In fact, the circuits have rejected the intervening felony theory. So I'd suggest that every clue that any defense attorney was giving would have been, as soon as you pled guilty, you were, in fact, a person prohibited, and you
now,
should stay with the firearms.
You said at the guilty plea colloquy, this defendant would have been asked if he realized one of the consequences was you can't possess a firearm. Is that something we find in this record, or is that something that you just remember as a matter of course?
I'm sorry, I was just talking about generalized knowledge of how pleas work. I don't know that that's true, but certainly,
it would make a difference if we're talking about notice and knowledge, and as a condition for accepting your guilty plea, you're told one of the consequences of pleading guilty is you can't possess a firearm, then that would satisfy some of these due process concerns because you'd be specifically on notice before you entered your plea.
That would certainly go a lot further in ensuring that, but the mere act, I mean, the truth of the matter is the statute is there and the definition of conviction is in the statute. They don't have to have specific knowledge.
I understand that, but you brought it up. So my question is, would we find that in this record, that prior to the entry of his guilty plea, he was on actual notice?
And the 1993, 1994 guilty pleas, I do not know. I no one ever dug that deeply into those records. But the real question, these were convictions that were predating this act that was going to be enhanced by 13 or so years.
I'm trying to understand, however, why you told us that if it's not in the record or it doesn't happen as a matter of course. I mean, I'm happy to take it out of the equation for purposes of deciding this case, but when I heard you say it, I said, well, that makes a difference if everybody's told this. And then I said, gosh, we should go find that in this record.
The problem, and I was discussing more generally the fact that there are various ways in which people have knowledge. The problem with that being really that the tipping point in this would be that when somebody is found guilty by a jury, the judge doesn't say, by the way, now you're a convicted felon and you can't have a weapon once you walk out the door here, if you walk out the door, front door.
So with a guilty plea, isn't it in the guilty plea form?
Yes, and that was what I was discussing at the time, that generally they would have knowledge, more specific knowledge, just because of the nature of how pleas are entered here in Delaware.
So it's possible if we searched the records and found this prior guilty plea form, we would discover this was in his particular guilty plea form.
From my knowledge, it's more than possible. It's probable. He entered two separate pleas. My guess would be that it's in both his colloquy and on the guilty plea form. But I can't tell the court that I've specifically looked at that. If there are no further questions, I see that my time is just about up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you again. Just to touch on a couple of points, whether or not an individual would be on notice.
Well, let's assume in your answer, whatever you're going to say, that it was in the guilty plea form. So you were on notice, and then you went and did it anyway. Isn't that a relevant fact?
Well, and it is, and we are not arguing that he should not be subject to any penalty-enhancing provision. I mean, we are arguing that because there is inconsistency in interpreting what a conviction is, that can anyone be given actual notice of what a conviction is if there's two lines of interpretations of what conviction means?
Well, Mr. Wallace says that we have a distinction between conviction and sentencing, and that the focus on sentencing really relates to many procedural aspects. For example, finality for purposes of a direct appeal, or when you're computing a procedural bar under a Rule 61 motion for post-conviction relief.
And that is one aspect of it. And as the court in Anderson points out, that this court, I guess for procedural purposes, does not deem a case ripe for appeal until sentencing occurs. But it also gives us some real concrete ending point for a case or a conviction. So we think that
Section 222, subparagraph 3, defines conviction of Title 11 as a plea of guilty. And it doesn't require sentencing for purposes of that definition. Do you agree?
I do agree that that's in the statute under the definition. But
so everyone's on notice of that, at least constructively.
Absolutely. But when we talk about a penalty-enhancing statute, I believe that there must be separate and distinct opportunities to rehabilitate. And I think Hall and Buckingham were logical in the court's opinion.
Well, is it your position that that's the intent of the General Assembly?
Well, looking at the statute itself, it does contemplate a sentence being imposed.
Well, is the answer yes or no?
Yes.
Is that the intent?
Well, yes, that would I would think that's the reasonable conclusion by reading the statute and seeing that. And while the subsection specifically that applies in this case, or the subsections, don't have that language, at least in the middle section, which is computing time, 10 years, it does contemplate a 10-year, contemplate a sentence that is imposed. And the ending of that sentence is when you start the 10 years. It's not when the person is convicted or pleads guilty. It's when the person's sentence is finished. So I would have to assume that the sentence theory or the sentence theory is applicable to the entire statute, and that is our argument. Because there was no dispute at the trial court level that Mr. Ross was not subject to 4214A for the same reasons we're arguing he's not subject to 1448. And there's inconsistency there. And we, you know, the courts, as this court pointed out in Hall, you know, don't be afraid of the convicted felon escaping punishment, because the trial judges still have the discretion to impose a more severe or less severe penalty as it so chooses, because there's a great range of flexibility and discretion in the trial court's ability to sentence a convicted felon. So we have some concerns of how this statute affects outcomes of cases. And in this specific case, we knew that the habitual offender statute didn't apply. But yet, the 14.
Was the defendant told on the guilty plea form as to minimum sentence?
He was
plea colloquy.
In this instance, I don't know about the 90s, but in this case, I was the attorney, and he was told that he could receive either a 5-year minimum mandatory sentence, which he did, or a 1-year minimum mandatory sentence.
So he was told it was unclear.
Yes, and we told the judge that, and the sentencing court declined to follow the reasoning in Buckingham and Hall, and preserve the issue for this court, I guess, to decide. I don't think the court should gloss over the fact that in the Anderson case, which we had provided, because it's the closest case on point, the state was arguing exactly what we are arguing here today, and the court was convinced that the reasoning in Hall and Buckingham should be followed. And the situation in that case is one where the juvenile was adjudicated guilty, didn't appear for his sentencing, absconded, and was later sentenced. About 6 months had passed. And, of course, this is the case where he picks up a new conviction within the 12-month time period of his sentence, but after the 12-month time period of his conviction. So the court found that he was subject to the penalty-enhancing statute because the sentence theory, if I can shorthand it that way, was more logical, was more reasonable in following that line of cases. And it is clear that there's a split amongst all authorities in this country about what a conviction is. And we believe that this court has decided via Hall and Buckingham that it's the sentence that must be imposed in order to satisfy what a conviction is. Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please pause.